Welcome. My name is Katarzyna Monika Pawlak. I'm the social media training editor of UWG Journal, and you're listening to UWG Journal podcast. We bring you here a selection of the best papers. Each episode will highlight one of the most relevant articles recently published in the journal in order to learn from the most up-to-date evidence and discuss with the authors the relevant findings of their research. Today is April 21st, and this is the second episode of the UWG Journal podcast. We have the privilege of having here Professor Stefan Milke, and together with Iago Rodriguez-Lago, the trainee editor of UWG Journal, they will be discussing the recent European guidelines on microscopic colitis.
Can you please introduce yourself and the working group that participated in the consensus document?
Yes, of course. Thank you very much for the invitation to this podcast activity. My name is Stefan Milke. I am a gastroenterologist in private practice in Hamburg, Germany. And I'm also affiliated with the University Hospital Hamburg-Eppendorf, which is nearby around the corner. And this is my clinical setup, and the specialty of my private practice is IBD, of course. And I'm working on microscopic colitis for over 20 years now. So I'm also the vice president of EMCG. This is a European Microscopic Colitis group, which has been founded 11 years ago, in fact. And I also served as the coordinator for this recent European guideline, which has now been published in UWG Journal. The guideline working group consisted of 32 clinicians and researchers from 14 European countries. And all of these participants are also active members of the EMCG, so they are very dedicated to microscopic colitis. So this was the working group working on this guideline.
Thank you. So we already know the group. So can you please tell us why did you start this activity, this consensus, and what were the reasons?
Well, the reason obviously is that there was no European guideline so far on microscopic colitis. And luckily, the UWG initiated a quality of care program a couple of years ago. And what they did, they made a gap analysis and they identified the need for certain topics, for certain GI diseases where no clinical guidelines exist in Europe. So, and we were aware of this program, and therefore the EMCG applied for this UWG grant in order to have the possibility and the financial resources to develop a guideline. And this was the starting point. And of course, the reason is to improve patient care and to harmonize the clinical management of microscopic colitis across Europe. And Perfect. We applied for that, and luckily we got the grant. Very quickly, and therefore we started to work on it beginning, I think, in 2018 was the application. And then we started at the end of 2018 with a kickoff meeting, and no, I'm wrong, 2019, sorry. And so we finished it last year, 2020.
Please, can you tell us the main recommendations regarding the diagnosis of microscopic colitis that were included in the consensus?
Yeah, there were actually a few recommendations which are kind of new or different from previous recommendations from expert papers, etc. And one is dealing with the number of biopsies which you need to take from the colon to make a firm diagnosis. So there has been a long discussion for many years where to biopsy, how many biopsies do I have to take in order to make a safe diagnosis. And so this is, in my view, is a new recommendation based on data that we have from large cohorts where the entire colon has been biopsied and the histopathology has been analyzed very detailed and with the statistics that you need. And so the recommendation that we agreed on and the guideline was to take at least two biopsies from the right colon and two biopsies from the left colon. So you don't have to biopsy the entire colon. There have been previous recommendations in this sense, but in our view, this is not necessary. And again, this is based on large cohorts of colonic biopsies that we analyzed from our clinical trials. So if you just take from the left and the light and the, from the right and the left codon, you have a sensitivity or diagnostic yield of close to 100%. So you don't have to take more. And this is, of course, important in terms of cost savings and so on. Left colon meaning descending colon, not sigmoid colon or rectum, because the miss rate for the diagnosis is higher in these areas. So the left colon means actually the descending colon. So this is one important recommendation, which has a practical implication because it saves time and costs. And I think this is important. And a second one is regarding the histological criteria for collagenous and lymphocytic colitis. They are well established and it didn't change in the current guidelines. So we re-established these criteria, meaning for the collagenous band more than 10 micrometers to make the diagnosis, and for lymphocytic colitis, at least 20 intraepithelial lymphocytes. So these are the established cutoffs, and this has been re-established. But in addition, we also defined and proposed histological criteria for incomplete microscopic colitis. And this is new because this has not been addressed in previous papers or recommendations. So incomplete microscopic colitis, meaning patients with chronic diarrhea, the same clinical appearance, but on biopsy, you have a microscopic a collagenous band, which is thickened, but it's not reaching 10 micrometers. So somewhere between 5 and 10 micrometers, and in combination with the inflammation of the lamina propria. So this is the criteria for incomplete microscopic colitis from the collagenous type. And for incomplete lymphocytic colitis, the diagnostic criteria would be more than 10, but less than 20 intraepithelial lymphocytes per 100 epithelial cells. So this is a new statement or recommendation to define this type of incomplete forms of microscopic colitis. Another point is which we address is fecal calprotectin, because this question comes up very frequently. Is it useful or not? And to make a long story short, it is not useful. There are several studies also showing significant differences between patients with microscopic colitis controls, but there's a huge overlap. So, and it is not helpful for excluding microscopic colitis. If you have a patient with chronic diarrhea, not yet endoscopy performed, so it's not possible to rule out microscopic colitis based on a normal calprotectin. So therefore, it's not useful, and it's also not useful in monitoring the disease. So when you have the diagnosis, you treat the patient, it does not give any additional value in addition to the symptom follow-up. So there's no point in using calprotectin. And this also refers to other fecal markers like eosinophilic markers, lactoferrin, et cetera. So there has been studies performed in the past and none of these studies was really conclusive or helpful. And one final statement or recommendation regarding diagnosis workup. We do also recommend, if you have a patient with a new diagnosis with microscopic colitis, or even in a patient with known diagnosis, you should screen for celiac disease at one point in time, because the prevalence of celiac disease is higher in patients with microscopic colitis compared to the general population. It's about tenfold higher, so you should screen for this. When you have a new patient with microscopic colitis, or even in a patient who is refractory to treatment and has not been checked, then at this point, the patient should also be checked for celiac disease.
And you recommend to check for celiac disease with the antibodies or with the biopsies?
Yeah, I think the serology is fine.
Well, thank you. Great. And which is the preferred approach for the initial treatment? That's the main question that we have in clinical practice, a very useful question that we all have in the clinic. So please feel free to answer.
Yeah, I think this question is rather an easy one because the preferred treatment approach, and this has also been stated in the guideline based on the data, the preferred treatment approach in active microscopic colitis should be oral budesonide, 9 mg per day. We have now 7 randomized controlled trials, placebo-controlled trials, including 4 trials in collagenous colitis and 3 trials in lymphocytic colitis on induction therapy with budesonide, 9 mg. So this is evidence-based, and this is actually the only drug where which is evidence-based for the treatment of microscopic colitis, and it's also the only drug licensed for the treatment of microscopic colitis. There is no other one. So, and based on the, we also performed a meta-analysis during the guideline process, and we calculated a overall clinical remission rate of 81% for collagenous colitis after 6 to 8 weeks of treatment, and 84% for lymphocytic colitis. So it's quite active and quite efficacious. So this should be the treatment of choice, the first line treatment of choice in patients with active disease. So if you have a patient who is intolerant to budesonide, which is rare, but it can happen, then it depends on the clinical activity of the patient. If it's only mild activity or moderate activity, of course, you can try to work with loperamide or cholestyramine in order to implement an entry secretory agent. This can be used in milder cases. It's more difficult in patients with highly active disease, with 10 to 20 watery stools per day. And if these patients do not respond to budesonide and you have no other causes of diarrhea, so these would be the patients where we today would propose and to consider actually biologicals like adalimumab or infliximab. Because there are only a few trials or not really trials, small cohort studies reporting efficacy to these biologics in these highly active patients who are not responsive to budesonide. So this would be, but in general, the primary approach, of course, is budesonide and helps the majority of patients. So, but you end up with 10 to 20% of patients where it can be difficult. And then you have to consider these other options. We have negative recommendations for some drugs like mesalazine. So we do not recommend to use mesalazine, which is quite often used in clinical practice in these patients, because we have no data to support this. We have 2 randomized placebo-controlled trials where there was also a mesalazine arm, one in collagenous colitis and one in lymphocytic colitis. And in both studies, mesalazine was not better than placebo. Although it was not the primary endpoints of these studies, it was a secondary endpoint. But so this is an argument against the use of mesalazine. And we also did not recommend the use of bismuth. This is also a question that comes often up, especially from North America, because it's not established there, but the colleagues there use it from time to time because it's available. And there are only very, very few data from the US. And if you look at older review articles and expert opinion papers from North America, you also see bismuth as a recommendation. We don't use it in Europe. And in most European countries, it's not available at all. And so this is one reason, or the second reason. No data to support this. It's not available. And also there are concerns regarding the long-term treatment with these drugs in terms of neurotoxicity. So, and many of the patients need longer treatment concepts. So in our view, it's not really useful for MC, and therefore we don't recommend it.
Right. And a practical question in addition to this initial management, do you recommend calcium and vitamin D in patients that are treated with budesonide?
Yes, if it comes to long-term treatment. So for the initial treatment, it's not necessary because short-term treatment with budesonide does not change anything in bone metabolism. So there's no need to implement this in the beginning. But if you have a patient who turns out to need long-term treatment with low-dose budesonide, there we recommend the supplementation of calcium and vitamin D. although there is no data to support this. So there is no prospective data to show that this makes sense. And we even have data showing that these patients probably don't even have a risk of osteoporosis in the long term. But for precautious reason, we recommend this in the guideline. But again, there are no data to show a benefit.
That was my question, because in Crohn's disease or with microscopic colitis, you usually have this question from some colleagues. So nice to have your feedback.
Yeah, well, the question is very important because these are usually older patients compared to the traditional IBD patients.
Women.
Predominantly females, a high proportion of smokers. So they already have a high risk of osteoporosis in the first place. And then you come with a steroid for long-term treatment. So so the question is very important. And we do it in clinical practice, and we also recommend it, but we don't have studies to show that you can decrease the risk of osteoporosis in the future. So this actually has to be done. It would be nice to make more studies in this field.
Great. And I think that this links perfectly with the next question, because we were asking you about if you can give us an overview about the next steps in the treatment algorithm in the long term and in the follow-up. How can we manage after this first treatment with budesonide? How can we approach these patients?
Yeah, well, the long-term strategy, of course, is in patients who do respond to budesonide. So the preferred long-term treatment is low-dose budesonide. This is also backed up by 3 randomized controlled trials, 1 over 6 months and 1 over 12 months. And you should try to find the lowest possible dose, which keeps the patient in remission. So between 0 and 6 milligrams per day is fine. And only if a patient turned out to need frequently higher doses than 6 milligrams per day, then you need to do something else, or you should consider other treatment options. But this should be the preferred long-term strategy. We right now discussing in the EMCG group, because we often in clinical practice, we observe patients who have a fixed dose per day and they take it for months or years. And nobody is thinking about a different strategy. So what we are thinking right now is a kind of on-demand treatment with budesonide, like in reflux disease with PPIs, symptom-driven. Because this is a symptom-driven disease, we are not concerned about structural damage to the organ. These patients have not an increased risk of colonic cancer. So we don't have to be concerned about these issues. So, and the primary goal of treatment is symptom relief and improvement of quality of life, which is significantly impaired in these patients. So this is basically the ideal setting for an on-demand treatment approach. And we are currently thinking about a prospective study to study an on-demand budesonide therapy for long-term treatment. So this is a question to your answer to your question, what's next? So we are working on this. We certainly need more data on incomplete microscopic colitis. So these patients have to be identified more often and studied in more detail. Fecal biomarkers is certainly an issue because we don't have any other clinical markers or parameters to help us to assess clinical activity or to monitor these patients. So the identification of useful fecal biomarkers is really an issue, in my view, which needs more studies, and also clinical activity scores. This is also a lack of knowledge right now. There are no real established clinical activity scores like CDAE and IBD. So we are currently working on this, and within the EMCG group, we try to develop an MCDAE index based on a panel of symptoms, not only diarrhea or stool frequency, because this is not enough. Because the patients have many other symptoms, as you know, they have nocturnal diarrhea, they have fecal urgency, and these kind of symptoms are also very important for the patients and have an even stronger impact on the patient's quality of life than just the stool frequency. And therefore, we try to implement these symptoms as well to develop a clinical activity score to assess activity to grade activity, and at least mild, moderate, and severe, which can be used in clinical practice. So these are research questions we are currently addressing in the EMCG group.
And after the first treatment with budesonide, when will you consider a second line therapy like azathioprine or some biologics?
You mean in refractory patients or?
Yes, yes.
Well, azathioprine can be used in some patients. It works even in younger patients. So this is just based on clinical experience. What we have seen is that, especially in these elderly patients, they don't tolerate azathioprine that good. So we have a high number of patients who stop treatment due to side effects. And so this is a limitation. But in younger patients, we have many patients which are like 40 or 45 years of age at the time of diagnosis. And in these patients, azathioprine can be considered, and in many cases it works. So before, so in this patient group, I would switch to azathioprine. But in elderly patients, this is not that successful. So in these patients, you might think, depending again on the clinical activity, this is very important. If the patient is doing fine with loperamide and cholesteramine, that's fine. Then you don't need to think about biologics. But if the patient has severe activity, a lot of loss of liquid and these kind of things, and is severely impacted by the disease, then biologics may be a good choice. And either adalimumab or infliximab. And there are only few data on vedolizumab, only a couple of patients reported in literature. So these are the biologics that could be considered in these individual cases. It's always an individual decision. It's never a one size fits all. So you have to take a look at the patient, the condition of the patient, the age, his preferences, and so on.
And this is more a personal question. Do you have some experience with methotrexate in this condition?
No, we actually never used it. And in my practice, I don't use it. And in most of the European centers, it's not really used. The data are very inconsistent. There are more negative studies than positive studies. And the positive studies are very hard to read because they just describe improvement, but they don't tell us what improvement means. So it's very difficult to read these papers appropriately or to make firm conclusions. And therefore, we in this recent guideline, we also do not recommend methotrexate. So this is on the list of not recommended medications.
Perfect. Thank you. And so the final question, we would like to hear what's going on in the European microscopy group. So what's next, what's going on, and what will be the next steps after this consensus?
Yeah, well, as I told you just a few minutes ago, we are working on clinical activity scores. We would like to, this is what we do right now, we try to develop a clinical protocol for a prospective study on on-demand budesonide therapy. So these are two projects which are going on right now. From the clinical guideline work, we have some materials left over, like what is Yamil working on the pathogenesis of microscopic colitis. So we are right now writing a huge paper on this issue to summarize all the data that has been published so far on microscopic colitis. So this is ongoing, and we also took plan another study on the epidemiology of microscopic colitis. And we would like to see more on fecal biomarkers, but this is not currently worked on by our group. So hopefully anybody else is picking this up. It's not that easy to find ideal markers and companies to support this. And of course, we have our prospective registry, the European registry, which has been started a couple of years ago, also supported by UEG grant. And we just published 1 year data in a Journal of Crohn's Colitis a few weeks ago. And of course, this registry is ongoing. So these are incident cases, new cases of MC who enter the registry and then follow up over up to 5 years. This is the plan. So this is also ongoing, of course, to learn more about the long-term cause of microscopic colitis, and also these questions like osteoporosis and these kind of things we try to study in this registry.
Great. Thank you for your time and for accepting the invitation, because it's a real pleasure for us to have a key leader in this disease to have this conversation.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure for me as well.
We hope that you enjoyed this interview, and please subscribe for further updates. Thank you and see you again.